All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And our show today is going to be a little wild. It should be kind of interesting. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Ricky Lee Jones. That's right. She's going to be coming back into the studio. And we're going to be talking about her last album, which is The Devil You Know. And it's actually Ricky's interpretation of a lot of songs that all y'all know very well. But she brings a whole different heart and a whole different understanding to them. It'll be a really interesting conversation and really interesting music. I tell you, I really like it a lot. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Douglas. Carl Douglas is an attorney representing David Cunningham III, a judge who found himself on the receiving end of police brutality because of the color of his skin. So stay tuned for that one. And opening the show up, you know, people, I don't know if people remember this, but a few weeks ago or months, a couple months ago or whatever it was, I made a... you know, I did this little rant about de Blasio because I was hearing so many people talking about, oh, Bill de Blasio, the savior of the people. Oh, he's going to be so good. This is going to represent a whole turnaround for New York City and possibly just be the spear point for turning around everything everywhere. That this was really, people were really told that this would change the face of the city and of everything else. A liberal friend of the people was taking the place of a series of harsh Republican administrations, and one of his big promises was meaningful reform to stop and frisk. Meaningful reform to stop and frisk, an official policy of racial profiling and harassment, especially of Black and Latino youth. So what's one of the first things he does when he gets into office? He appoints William J. Bratton as the new police commissioner. And Bratton is one of the country's top cops, former police chief of Boston, New York, and L.A. And everywhere he's gone, he's brought more repression down on the people. And what does Bratton have to say about stop and frisk? Well, if the cops are not doing stop and frisk, then they're not doing their jobs. That's just one of the things he says. And joining us to talk about all of this is Carl Dix, from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Well, you heard what I was saying. You've heard it before. You've spoken about this a lot yourself. De Blasio comes in on a river of promises, the big one around reform of the police, and in particular stop and frisk. Then his first move is to appoint Bratton as police commissioner, calling him a progressive visionary. What the hell's going on there, Carl?
Well, what's going on is that people are being sold a bill of goods, and unfortunately, too many of them are lining up to buy it, because that's what this comes down to. I mean, William Bratton was police chief here in New York City in the mid-1990s under Rudolph or Adolph Giuliani. He presided over the murders by the police of dozens of mostly young Black Latino men. When parents of these murder victims of his police department came to police, you know, community meetings to complain about the fact that the murderers of their children were not being held to any accountability, really investigated, Bratton and Giuliani called them fools who should shut up. This is the stance that they took. Now he's being brought back after having circled through L.A. as a progressive reformer who is going to deal with tattered relations between the community and the police. People need to open their eyes to what's really going on here, because Bratton not only made the statement about stop and frisk is a necessary police tool, his entire career as a top cop has been based on what he calls the broken windows theory of policing, which comes down to if small things are allowed people are allowed to get away with small things, then they'll do big things. But what this has meant is that things that aren't even crimes get treated as crimes, targeting especially Black and Latino people, and it comes down to criminalizing whole generations of people and a method of intense social control. That's what Bratton has stood for. He stood for that from his years as police chief in New York, in Boston, in L.A., and back in New York. And what that means is that perhaps in another form, perhaps a reformed way, but what was going on under the stopping frisk is going to continue.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is, it's very heavy because to me, it's actually, when you think about this, you know, Bratton actually, he sort of, I don't know if he actually founded Stop and Frisk, but when he first came into, some position of prominence in the New York City Police Department, he actually advocated or he put into practice something called zero tolerance, which was focused a lot on the subways against youth. And then he built from there, right? So this is not like, this is like a longstanding program. This isn't just something he was confronting, a major problem of the day that had to be resolved, and it was just a temporary thing. But he's rooted in this kind of approach to things, right?
Yes, it really is like we can't tolerate anything. So people on the corners with squeegees trying to clean car windows, we got to get rid of that. We got to take care of that. But then it went beyond that to youth just hanging out with their friends, playing, whatever, get swept up. And initially it was being done, back in Bratton's day, it was being done by militarized units within the police called the Street Crimes Unit. And as a reform, when the Bloomberg administration came in, they broke up the Street Crimes Unit, but spread Stop and Frisk through the entire NYPD. So Stop and Frisk itself was touted as a reform by spreading it through the entire police department. And whatever reform they come up with this time, there's going to be a continuation of this criminalization. Because I was looking at Bratton's record in L.A., and the approach that he took in L.A. was, I'm going to repair the relations between the communities and the police by targeting the bad guys, the gang members. But then being a gang member, it reminded me a lot of the approach of Stop and Frisk, because when the cops wrote up why they stopped and frisked people, they would say these people looked like criminal suspects. They dressed like criminal suspects. They walked like criminal suspects. And through the gang injunctions, it went from a certain number of people were gang members to people who wore clothing similar to what gang members might wear, people who walked like them. So it became a thing of spreading that out, and through the gang injunctions in L.A., targeting the youth very broadly, while also trying to bring some figures in the Black and Latino communities on board with this approach of going after the gangsters. And there's actually a basis to do similar things in New York, looking at some programs that they were adopting even before the new mayor and new police chief came in.
Quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the appointment of William J. Bratton as police commissioner in New York under the new liberal mayor, Bill de Blasio. Now, Carl, one of the things that shocks a lot of people, because I think a lot of people think about Stop and Frisk, and they think, okay, there's some things that you just, you know, there may be, it may overstep the bounds, at boundaries at some point. It may, you know, it may be a little intense, but I don't think people really get the sweeping nature of it and the depth of it and the impact that it actually has in real time, in real life, you know, the impact that it actually has on a whole section of people, particularly Black and brown young people. You know, and you look at this, and I was thinking about the Amnesty International report that just looked at Bratton's 2 years in New York as commissioner before this time, and talked about what had happened, how everything under what he was doing with all the Stop and Frisk and everything, how everything became, you know, just went, it skyrocketed till you got a situation today where, you know, how many millions of people have been, you know, victims of Stop and Frisk, and what has it resulted in?
Yes, over the period of from 2004 to 2012, 5 million people have been stopped and frisked by the NYPD. And we should keep in mind that constant with this, more than 85% of them were Black or Latino, and more than 90% of them were found by the police to be doing nothing wrong. But then we can even get more sharp on this, because in 2011, the NYPD stopped and frisked 150,000 black males between the ages of 15 and 24. There are less than 150,000 black males in New York City between that age. So they were stopping people several times in that period. That's how they got to those numbers. And it came down to that people would be stopped repeatedly on the way to school, on the way home from school, on the way to work, or on the way home from work. And it was pretty clear that something was being said to them. You are a criminal. You're suspected of being a criminal because you're young and black, not because of anything that you've done, not because of anything that the cops witnessed you doing or suspected that you did. It was just because of who you are. And that's what was being dealt with. And see, the whole thing behind de Blasio and this thing about progressive reformer is that it was a big problem for the powers that be, that people were beginning to look at their police and their use of force as being illegitimate, that it wasn't coming from trying to stop crime or keep anybody safe, but that it was targeting people on the basis of the color of their skin or of their nationality.
All right, Carl, I want to get into that in a second, but let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about newly elected, or newly assuming the mayor's office, de Blasio, Bill de Blasio in New York City, and his appointment of William Bratton as the police commissioner, and what that means for what's facing, you know, millions and millions of people, especially black and brown youth, what's facing people in terms of the kinds of police operations, of police repression, and actually, frankly, the whole thing that we'll talk about a little bit later, but about the whole question of how this ties in with the overall genocidal program that is in effect and in motion. Now, Carl, let's get into this, because de Blasio has said, you know, look, I have a problem with stop and frisk. I'm going to reform stop and frisk. You know, and he does this point that he has said frequently is the breakdown of relations. This is a problem. It's broken down what should be good relations between people and the police in New York City. These neighborhoods should be, you know, just areas where people see themselves as like the, you know, fat old Mickey O'Shaughnessy walking down the street twirling his baton, and people coming and up and saying, "Mickey, Mickey, we got the dog, the cat in the tree." I was going to say the dog in the tree. That's my kind of life, right? But we got the cat in the tree. You know, come and help us. But this is a whole different scene when you're starting to talk about de Blasio's problem with stop and frisk, talking about the breakdowns between relations between the people and the police. Let's get into that.
Yes, I mean, this was very important, because when Cornel West and I issued the call for a campaign of civil disobedience to stop and frisk, we were actually going at that this is illegitimate and unacceptable, and it needed to be stopped, and that we needed to transform the way that people thought about that. We needed to go to people who were being hit with this and who felt there was nothing that could be done about it and let them know, no, this is not acceptable. We need to stand against it. And we needed to go to people who weren't being hit by it and who were being told that this was to keep them safe and say, no, that's not what this is about. This is unfairly targeting people based on the color of their skin. And through that and other things, this message began to reach people that, like, wait a minute, something is wrong here. People are being targeted just because of who they are, not because of anything that they've done. And it began to hit with people that, like, this isn't something we should stand by and let happen, you know, and this is a big problem for the capitalist rulers of this country, because what's driving all of this, it isn't even that we get the wrong elected officials or the wrong police chiefs or the wrong cops or anything like that. What it is that there is a system that at this point has millions and millions of people, especially in the inner cities, that it can no longer profitably exploit. It can't fit them into its globalized economic setup. But these people are here, and the approach to that has been to clamp down a very tight mechanisms of social control, and that is where mass incarceration and all of its consequences came out of. That's what we're dealing with, a system that has millions and millions of people that it can't profitably involve in its economic setup, but can't just let them hang around because they remember the 1960s and the way that black people rose up against the conditions being enforced on them and how it infected the population much more broadly and ended up spearheading a broader revolutionary movement that rocked the system back on its heels. So they're trying to avoid that and figure out what they do. And mass incarceration has been the way to do that. And then policies like stop and frisk, like gang injunctions, have been ways and mechanisms to carry that out and to give it a veneer of justification and legitimacy. But when that veneer gets pulled off of it, they got to work to repair that. And that's the whole thing with the de Blasio's, and actually before that, frankly, the Obamas, although that was in a more international arena that they were doing that.
Mm-hmm. Quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the appointment of William J. Bratton as police commissioner in New York under the new liberal mayor, Bill de Blasio. Well, let's talk some about people's response to this, because I got to say, I mean, one of the things that I did when I was introducing this, I did get really upset, you know, and I should have been a little bit, you know, just not so upset. I mean, like I got really, you know, it's frustrating because you'd hear these people, you know, who you keep thinking, how many times, you know, that analogy of Lucy and Charlie Brown, and Lucy's swearing to Charlie Brown forever and ever that she's not going to lift the football up this time, but that sucker just keeps running, and every time she lifts it up, and every time he comes back, you know, and there's a point here around this whole thing of, you know, what was the response of people to this? You know, tell me, what was the response overall of people to this?
Well, there was a certain disappointment with the reappointment of Bratton, but then Bratton invited people, and especially people who had been involved in the police reform movement, to come to a meeting and to hear his ideas. And frankly, it was like offering the cup of coffee, drawing from Malcolm X, and people mostly could not turn down the offer to sit down at Mass's table and get a cup of coffee heavy on the cream. And all kinds of so-called anti-police brutality forces who know what Bratton's track record was, who knew he was not saying, I was wrong when I came in here on this broken window, zero tolerance policy. I apologize for having called the parents of police murder victims who came to meetings and were asking tough questions, fools who should shut up. He didn't back away from any of that. He went forward with all of that, but then wanted to draw people in. And too many people were going for that. Now, to their credit, some of those same parents of police murder victims here in New York City did not buy that. And while other people were going down to have a meeting with the new police chief, they were out in the streets. They held a protest in Harlem that drew hundreds of people protesting de Blasio's appointment of Bratton. And then at de Blasio's inauguration, they held another protest calling out, like, what does it mean that you talk about you're against stop and frisk, and then you bring in a police chief who, in his previous tenure, presided over the murder of dozens of our youth by the police and backed the police in doing that to the hilt, and who has come back into office saying stop and frisk is a necessary tool. So there are kind of counter currents going on. On the one hand, people being drawn towards, can we sit down with these people and work something out, an approach that has never worked for the people, while it has worked for the powers that be, while there are other people saying, it was unacceptable when you brutalized and murdered our children before, and we are not going to, you know, be drawn into an approach that continues that brutalization and that murder.
All right, Carl, we have a couple of minutes left, maybe 2 minutes, and I wanted to ask you this, the game plan. Let's put this in the context of the bigger picture. What are you saying in terms of, you know, there's one thing for people being in the streets, there's other people divided out and saying, okay, give them a chance, or maybe even, you know, we'll see what's going to happen here. And I've also read things where some fools are saying, look, you know, he learned his lesson. He became a different person in Los Angeles. And you've laid out already what the history of that was, what he actually, what his program here was. But let's talk about this in terms of the big plan. What's the game plan for now as far as you see it?
As far as I see it, I mean, there have been recent articles in the New York Times about how the NYPD is adopting different approaches. But these different approaches are very insidious. They are scouring YouTube for cultural expressions from youth in the neighborhood and using these to put together conspiracy cases. And there are people who are in jail now, and the police are touting this, who are in jail because they did a rap song that referred to a beef in a neighborhood. And the police are putting this into the form of a conspiracy and rounding up people who were involved in doing these rap songs or associated with the people who did the rap songs. The other thing that they're doing is that if there is a killing among the people in a neighborhood, people who know the guy who got killed get visited and sweated by the NYPD as potential violent actors who the cops are going to sit on before they can make a move. And this strikes me as something that could take the form of doing things like this as the way in which to carry forward with this intensification of criminalization of the youth and doing it under a different banner than stop and frisk. We need to look at that and learn from the example of the parents who said, look, we are not going to come and sit down and get a cup of coffee and talk with you because you're still saying stop and frisk is necessary. You're not backing away from zero tolerance. And your zero tolerance has been massive criminalization of our youth. So we need to go into 2014 on the offensive against this kind of criminalization, against mass incarceration and all of its consequences. And people should be on the lookout for plans and approaches to that. They should look at the website revcom.us, because I'm going to be writing and speaking on it there. And they should also go to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website, which is stopmassincarceration.net.
All right, Carl, we're going to have to cut it off there, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Mike.
All right, take care, man. Talk to you soon. All right, I just want to leave people with one little, something to think about, something to chew on. And this is from Bob Avakian and his book Basics. It's a quote in his book Basics. And it goes like this. It says, the role of the police is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all of their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness. And you can find that in Bob Avakian's book, Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Carl Douglas, attorney for Judge Cunningham. All right. Boy, you can't beat that. That's Black and Blue from Kermit Ruffins. And I just felt there was so much irony tied up in all of that and so much and just such a great song. All right. Kermit Ruffins and Black and Blue. All right. Well, back in November of 2013, late November, David S. Cunningham III, a black Los Angeles County Superior Court judge, was driving his car, moving his car out of a parking lot and... In a matter of, who knows, minutes, he suddenly was in the vortex of a whole just unbelievable situation. He was pulled over. He was handcuffed, put in the back of a police car. Well, actually, instead of me telling you, why don't I have Carl Douglas, who's an attorney for David S. Cunningham, tell you all about him and what happened to him. Carl, welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. Who is David Cunningham and what happened to him?
David Cunningham is a 59-year-old Los Angeles Superior Court judge, the son of David Cunningham Jr., who was a Los Angeles City Councilman for over 10 years in Los Angeles. He is also the former president of the Los Angeles Police Commission, having served on that austere body for over 4 years. On Saturday morning, November 23rd, about 8 o'clock in the morning, David was pulling out of the parking lot of the L.A. Fitness Gym on Gailey Avenue, just north of Wilshire in Westwood. He had a black T-shirt. He had gym trunks on. He had been working out that morning. He had to unhook his seatbelt so he could reach in his pocket to get his wallet so he could pay for the parking rate at the counter there. The gate lifts up. He starts to pull out on the right, and as he's pulling down the street, 100 feet or so, he is now putting his seatbelt back into the clasp, driving down northbound on Gailey. A UCLA campus patrol car pulls up alongside of him. A block later, pulls David over because he did not have his seatbelt fastened, was the allegation. During the course of the stop, it became clear that the judge became annoyed at the lack of respect that this officer was treating him. In showing his wallet with his driver's license, there clearly was displayed a judicial ID badge. There also was clearly displayed a judicial badge, which looked like a law enforcement badge. He didn't show it. He was showing his license, but clearly those identifications were quite visible. And almost from the very beginning, there was this back and forth, sort of a who's in charge, I'm in charge kind of an attitude. I'm the one asking the questions, do as I say, which was quite off-putting and to which the judge objected. During the course of the stop, the judge began looking in his glove box for his insurance and registration, and an officer on the passenger side starts rapping on the window, roll down your window, roll down your window, which startled the judge and frightened him quite fairly. This judge, as a police commissioner, would review dozens, if not scores, of allegations of misconduct involving the police and the citizens in Los Angeles. So he's well aware of police procedure and the proper roles of police conduct with citizens. And he, quite frankly, was startled as he opens his glove box. A prescription pill of blood pressure medicine falls out, and the cop one says, what's that? Do you have drugs in your car? What's that? That again startles him. The judge recalls that his license and insurance were really in the back seat of his car. He couldn't find it in the glove box, and the cop takes his license and turns it, good God, and turns and walks away. I'll find it myself. And begins then to run his name on dispatch. I'm informed that when judges' names are run, there's an immediate identification of them as a member of the judiciary. That's how I'm informed. While they're running his name, judge remembers that his insurance and registration are in his trunk, and he steps out of the front door of his car, closes the door, and they say, what are you doing? Get back in the car. The judge says, what did I do? I've done nothing wrong. My license is in the trunk. Both officers approach him, rush him, turn him around, and handcuff him. Michael, because he did not have his seat belt on.
You know, Carl, well, let me remind listeners that we're talking to Carl Douglas, who's the attorney for David S. Cunningham III. Sorry, I just lost my place there. He's the attorney for David S. Cunningham III, a Los Angeles County Superior Court judge, a former president of the Los Angeles Police Commission, and a one-time federal civil rights attorney. And we're talking, you know, David was actually, he went through, you know, if you think about this, Carl, what unfolded there, what you described was something that happens on every level of society and life for black people, especially.
Correct.
You know, that's very heavy. We'll talk about that a little bit, because I understand Sure. That's something that really struck the judge, too, is that was all was going on.
The irony is, typically, These are called hurt feelings cases. The guy's ordered out of the car, sit on the curb. I hear them all too often. As a police commissioner, David read and saw about them all too often and kind of dismissed the seriousness of them. I've known David for more than 30 years, and when he first described the horror of what happened, he had to walk out of my office so he could cry. And I've known him for more than 30 years. It's a devastating impact on him, almost 60 years old. I have a 22-year-old son in Los Angeles. I was raised in L.A. I understand the history of the relations between citizens of that my community and the Los Angeles police. That's why I'm proudly a civil rights lawyer, trying to correct the wrongs two cups at a time.
You know, Carl, there's a point too that that the judge got into, and I think I read it somewhere where he was talking about when he was thrown into the police car, that suddenly he began to think about, like you said, he's come across these kinds of things, you know, all throughout his career, many, many, many times, in many different fashions, in many different ways of, you know, when he was doing different things. You would imagine, certainly as, you know, part of the police commission, you would also imagine in terms of being a superior court judge, but also, you know, like you're saying, reading things. But he said, one of the things that really struck me is he said that at a certain point, you know, when you're thinking about that, when I was talking about this being a classic rollout of what normally happens, you know, there is, you know, a lot of sort of coincidence, accident. And then the biggest thing is the determining factor is the color of one's skin. And he said that at a certain point, he really grasped the gravity of the situation, the potential danger, based on what he knows. And he said, I began to think about people who had other black men who had been in these kinds of confrontations, Devin Brown, Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin. And he realized that he was facing in a life-threatening situation.
That and the irony is, Bart up in Oakland hired David to investigate the Oscar Grant shooting civilly so that he can make recommendations in terms of how to improve the use of force for the Bart police station. So he was intimately aware, Michael, of how something seemingly benign could turn deadly in a moment's notice. And that's what frightened him. Also, the thing is to remember, there are two video cameras on these UCLA patrol cars, one looking forward from the dashboard and a second above the head of the driver looking into the back seat where the custodies are held. David did not want to be placed into the back of the police car because he was screaming for his liberty because it was wrong. While he was handcuffed, he didn't say he was a judge, but he said, I'm a former police commissioner. I know what you're doing. This is wrong. And to see him then sit down with his feet outside of the back door, they push his forehead backwards. He's a tall man, 6'1", probably. And his feet rise up, and he basically is then scrunched into the back of the car, laying handcuffed on his back, with his feet caught near the upper window of the back seat area. And he laid like that in that indignity for 2 or 3 minutes or more before he was able to right himself. I could not bear to watch the video. It was appalling.
Mm. Well, you know, we have time for one more question, Carl, and I want to get into that. It's the big question to pose to many is how does a situation like this, what seemingly would be a minor, just a bump in your life, in any day in your life, and especially in a place like Westwood, become such a dangerous and possibly life-threatening situation? And you pose the point. You yourself, talking about this, said this could happen to any black person on the streets of L.A. at any time. And I'd like you to talk about that in terms of trying to wrap this up a little bit, but really give people a sense of what were you talking about there, and why do you think that that's the case?
Clearly, though, we have an African-American president, and there have been great strides racially across this very nation. Racism still exists, even in Westwood. This was a case of racial profiling. Because of this man's race, he was treated differently than he would have been treated had he been Asian or Caucasian, I maintain. His stepping out of the car would not have been viewed in a violent, negative way by the Asian and Caucasian officers, even in 2014. This is more about money, Mike. This is about Rosa Parks. We're trying to have a conversation. There's a website, change.org, and there's a petition we're trying to get your listeners to be involved with about Judge Cunningham to let UCLA know this is wrong. We can't allow it to happen. There must be change.
Absolutely. You know, Carl, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think actually one thing to really remember, too, is that, you know, there is a point, as we were talking, I don't know if you heard any of my previous guests, Carl Dix, but this whole situation, you know, you look at things like, and even the people that the judge was mentioning, Trayvon Martin and Oscar Grant, you know, and you think about this, you know, time and time again, and how many people are killed innocent people are killed. How many people have been just funneled into what amounts to concrete slave ships these days, the prisons, the big prisons they got. Generation after generation of young black people, you know, just thrown into oblivion. And actually the genocidal implications of this, because when it can happen, when you talk about it can happen to a judge who was all the things that David Cunningham was and is, and it can happen to, you know, Oscar Grant.
None of us are safe.
That's exactly it, Carl. All right, Carl, thank you very much. And keep us informed on what's going on, all right?
Thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right, take care now. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Douglas, the attorney for David S. Cunningham III, the judge who was manhandled and abused simply because he was black by the UCLA police in the Westwood neighborhood of Los Angeles. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Ricky Lee Jones, one of my favorite people. All right, so I'm looking forward to this, and you should be too. So stay tuned.
Myself, I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long time. I've seen many a man's soul to waste. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. I made damn sure Pilate washed his hands and sealed his fate. Hey, pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name. What's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg, I saw it was a time for a change. I killed the Tsar and his ministers, and the stage and screamed in vain.
All right, I'm having a really hard time busting in on that. And that's Ricky Lee Jones from her album, The Devil You Know. And you know the song, Sympathy for the Devil. And it's a, you know, just something. I listen to that. Just what you're doing there, Ricky, is driving me crazy. Since I first heard the album, I got to talk to Ricky about this. This is the whole thing. And it's phenomenal because it's so, you've basically laid yourself open in a way, you know, that just, I think, resonates with anybody who's got a heart and a brain and whatever, you know. It wraps itself around you. Your voice is just incredible in this. And you know, I've followed your music for a long time. I've known you for a long while. But I've also just really, this album has really something. And you made a distinction. First of all, welcome to the damn show.
Hi, Michael. I'm so glad to be here. I'm in town for a few days, and thanks for having me over.
Yeah, well, you know, are you telling people that where you're living?
Yeah, sure. I moved this year to New Orleans. I had lived there for a little while in 1980. I had a little pad on Decatur Street by the river. But now I'm living in a place called Bayou St. John, which is about a mile and a half from the quarter.
All right. Now, I have to ask you, are you hanging out with Dr. John.
I don't think Mac lives there.
Oh.
But you know what? I got friends, you know, yeah. And I've been there just a couple months, and I have made, like, I got a friend that brought me to the airport, Michael. That's a real friend. And she made sure me and my dog got on, and I'm having a really, really renaissance.
Oh, great. Well, really this good. Is what I want to tell you, because this album, as I said, this album has been, it's something that's, in a way, you know, you've done things like this in a general sense, but this, what you've laid bare there of yourself and what you've brought to the music is really incredible. And you said that this marked a new point in your art. It took you to a different place in your art. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay. I think it did. You know, after I did it, I set it aside. But I'm finding now that when I sing and that it's exactly as you said, that I feel in touch. I don't feel afraid. I am who I am, and I fill up every corner of that now when I play. And I think, you know, when you lose money and you don't get a lot of acclaim in a business, that acclaim is, you know, well, it brings in money, but it brings in a satisfaction. When you don't get it, you can start to doubt yourself. So I don't know what happened, but singing these songs this way, I woke up and knew exactly who I am. I know who I am. Mm-hmm. This is how I sing. This is what I do. And I feel good. It's hard for me to talk about myself, but yeah.
Well, let me talk about okay. You then, okay?
Because you do it so good.
Yeah, well, you know. Let me ask you this question. Sympathy for the Devil. You know, most people, you know, look, when I was a kid, and probably when you were a kid too, you might have been doing the same thing. You just felt like there wasn't headbanging that back then, but boy, that song sort of grabbed you. The way that the Stones did it, they just sort of grabbed you, and
yeah.
It was an anthem. It was anthemic and iconic.
Yeah.
And then you've turned it, you know, and I wanted to talk with you about that, because what made you want to do that song in particular?
I just heard it. So sometimes when you write a song, it's almost like you hear it. It's already a finished thing. I heard me doing that song that way. I can't tell you why or how. I was invited to be part of a tribute at Carnegie Hall to the Rolling Stones. And I just started playing that song by myself. And this was always meant to be this. This song existed, always sung this way. It's an incredible production, but a song has to be able to stand on its own, just you and the song. And that one does.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to go to another one in a minute, but that also is one of my favorite songs, St. James Infirmary, which, you know, and I really like your version of that. But I wanted to ask you this, because you've talked about, you know, and I thought this was really important, because you've talked about, you know, you did these songs, and these are all songs that have been done by, you know, either by the people who wrote them,
yeah.
Or they've been done with other people. But you've also said that you don't like the concept of covers, you know, of labeling something a cover, because it demeans the art. And then you talked about the relationship between a singer and a song and the point of interpretation, which I thought was very good and very deep and very, very important.
The songs, there's a lot of images you could use, but they're like houses. They exist all by themselves. And when you go into them and make them your own, that's just what you do. They're not any more or less because you didn't build it. Because you didn't write it. I mean, it's better to say that it's like a movie. I mean, I can't even say what it is, but when I enter a song and make it my own, I don't feel any less of a connection to it than one that I sat and labored over the lyric. And when people call them covers, it's dismissive, and it suggests that the real art is coming. We're going to listen to you sing other people's songs. But I'm glad people like my idiosyncratic writing, my wonderful writing. It takes me so long to do. But, you know, that would mean like most of my career is spent waiting for the next thing. And I think a singer is the most important job. Frank Sinatra or whoever you love, they bring the song to you. I think, you know, the actor brings the line to you. God bless the writer, but without those people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm thinking, look, in all of these songs, I'm very familiar with, but not the way it was like, and I'm serious. Each time when I listened to
it differently.
Yeah, and each time I listened to this album, many times, and each time I listened to the songs, it was something that was completely new. For instance, here's one that's a really old song and actually has gotten some play recently with Llewyn Davis, you know, and the sort of the revival of Dave Van Ronk and people's interest in Dave Van Ronk and some of this. But you have a version of St. James Infirmary that just knocked my socks off, all right? Right. And I'm sure you see I got no socks on. Okay.
I learned that from my dad. I grew up hearing my dad sing that song.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you about. So let's listen to Teddy. Let's go do track 4 and play that out, all right?
Thank you. As I pass St. James Infirmary, I saw my sweetheart there, stretched out on the long white table, so cold, so gray, so fair. 16 cold black horses hitched up to a rubber tired hack, and taking 7 gals to the graveyard. Only 6 are coming back. Well, let her go, let her go. God bless her. But wherever she may be, she can look this wide world over. She'll never find a sweet, loving heart like me. Never find a sweet, loving man like me. Like me.
Oh, man. All right, Ricky. As that was playing, St. James Infirmary, Ricky Lee Jones, you're at listening to the Michael Slate Show on KPFK, and we're listening to selections from her album, The Devil You Know, and that was St. James Infirmary, as I said, and that's a hell of a rendition of that. That is just, I mean, I'm gone, all right? Yeah, I'll leave. You can keep on going. Tell people about that. You were talking about, you know, that it was something that you learned from your dad.
Right. My dad spent a little time in the South. You know, he was the son of a vaudevillian, and he ran away if he got in a lot of trouble. And when he was in the South, he learned these particular songs, like the one about Jesus on the cross or something. And he'd sing me these songs since I was very little. And when I went to do it with Ben, he put it in this hierarchy. But this song is so much, you know, a part of me, and envisioning the person passing by and seeing the one they loved laying dead on the table. This is like as close to me as any Mother Goose story, you know.
Yeah.
So when I sing it, I see my child. I can see my child, or I can be the man seeing his lover. It's fun to be these other people and sing these songs. I love being them.
But you bring something.
Fun is a weird word, huh? But
No, fun is a cool word, okay? We need more fun, all right? I want to be known as Mr. Fun, okay? Maybe Dr. Fun, be more prestigious.
Dr. Fun.
But here's the thing.
Michael Slate, badass Dr. Fun.
There you go. Oh, I hope they caught that. Anyway, here's the thing. It's fun, but it's also, you know, there's such, and I don't want to say raw, but there is, it's like, it's just open. It's open emotion. And you were talking, while the song was on, you were talking about feeling and how deep the deep role that played in doing this album. And you could see that in a song like that. And we'll talk about another song coming up, which I want to talk in a minute. But let's talk about this, about
the
feeling.
Subtext.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, I don't know why, but I think you're feeling the subtext of emotion that takes place in the songs, and all the sorrow and hope and resolution to your plot and plight and all those things that you feel in your life. They take place in the threads just under the sound of the voice. That's why the voice, anybody's voice, but that's why it's so moving. Whatever's happening in their lives at that time surely comes out in little dust and falls on you. You know what I mean? I don't know how to say it any other way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't want to be like, try to be editorial in the subtext of emotion, no. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what I wanted to hear, too. It's exactly the way you put it.
Well, there's one thing I wanted to mention really fast about the sympathy for the devil, because in singing a song, in, you know, for me, singing about prophets or devils or whatever, I get to become them. And in singing the song about the devil who loves murder and lies above all things, as you sing that song, you can pull all these things into it all by yourself. As wonderful as it is to see Mick and feel all the, you know, drumming and tribal thing, when you break that down by yourself and just say, I am here to hurt you. So be careful.
Now, is that what you're saying to me, Ricky? Because I'm moving way far away.
Because that's what that devil's saying, you know. Watch out, I'm here to hurt you.
Right, right.
And it's fun to remind people that that's what the song is really about.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the next song I want to play, and I'm just giving people a chance to hear pieces of this because I really encourage everybody to just get this, and they can get it at your site, right? And they can get it on iTunes.
Can I say something really fast?
Yeah,
I'm on pledgemusic.com. I'm trying to raise money to make my next record. I guess I should have told you that. I've only got a couple weeks left, and instead of going to the, you know, company and having them take all your money and never making any money and everybody always feeling like it was a failure somehow, I'm going to the people directly and they can just buy the CD ahead of time by purchasing it now, and then they finance me making the record.
Oh, great.
It's at pledgemusic.com and you can buy all those CDs there.
Okay, great, great. And I really recommend all those CDs, okay, because it's you never stop listening to it. So we're running up on our time, but I want to make real sure that we hear a little bit of this. This is a Van Morrison song that you picked for you really wanted this song. Tell us why, and then we'll listen to it.
I believe at the time, which is what the record's about, I was trying to send out these threads of comfort to my own child and into the past as well as into the future.
All right, Teddy, let's play that. That's Comfort You, and that's Ricky Lee Jones from her album, The Devil You Know. And that is just a beautiful interpretation of a really, really moving song, Van Morrison's song. Now, I'm going to do something that we don't normally do right now, but I'm going to say I want to thank all of you for listening today. You're listening to the Michael Slate Show. I'm the host and producer of the show, and Michael Slate, and I'm talking now with Ricky Lee Jones. I want to thank all of my other guests, Carl Dix, Carl Douglas, and Ricky again. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And you can follow us. You can follow the Michael Slate Show. You can follow Michael Slate. You can follow me everywhere and anywhere, but especially do it on Facebook and Twitter. And like us on Facebook, and you'll help us get those secret powers. We're still striving for those powers. We're close, but don't have the brass ring yet. So give us a help, all right? And I want to let you know, if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. And I said all that.
Or Badass Dr. Fun, as you now be known.
That's right. Badass Dr. Fun. Don't ever forget that, all right? I'm going to have to get a whole thing going on that. That's great, Ricky. All right, Ricky, I want to go out with the song that you pick. Now, it's either going to be Reason to Believe or Catch the Wind. And I want you to pick it real quick and tell me why.
Reason to Believe, because I love listening to Ben's guitar playing.
All right, I agree. So, Teddy, it's track 7. Let's go with that.
Never think about myself.